From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To The Point.
Does the world face another food crisis? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 2 years ago, widespread food shortages led to riots and other disruptions around the world. Is that about to happen again? The UN says, be prepared. Drought has led Russia to ban wheat exports, America's corn harvest is down, and climate change is helping to drive world prices higher. Meantime, farmers make more by using their land for sugar, cotton, soy, and biofuels. Is industrialized agriculture at fault? What are the prospects of another global food crisis, and what are the chances of heading it off? On Reporter's Notebook later on, tricked by the Taliban. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To The Point. 57 million Americans don't get enough to eat, and massive amounts of food go to waste. At the same time, much of the world depends on American agribusiness. Is going local a better way? On Reporter's Notebook, after months of secret talks about ending the war in Afghanistan, a supposed senior Taliban leader turns out to have been a fraud. First, this news update. For the first time since the Korean War, North Korea fired artillery shells onto South Korea's civilian territory today, killing two soldiers, wounding residents, and setting fire to houses on Yeonpyeong Island. North Korea says it was responding to shells fired at sea during a South Korean military exercise. Mike Chinoy is senior fellow at the China Institute at USC, and he's author of Meltdown, the Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
South Korea, of course, fired back on North Korean territory. What is the chance of this escalating even further?
Well, I think the overriding goal now of the United States government, the South Koreans, the Chinese, entire international community is going to be to try and prevent this from getting out of hand. And my guess is that it will probably be contained. I think the origins of this episode have to look at the very complicated dynamic between North and South Korea. You have a government in South Korea headed by President Lee Myung-bak, who is conservative, who's tried to take a more tougher approach towards North Korea than his two predecessors. And in the current, and in this area where the island is part of these disputed waters along what's called the Northern Limit Line, which is the naval demarcation line between the two Koreas. The North Koreans have never accepted the line, and Yeongpyeong is one of several islands that the South Koreans control, and there have been repeated clashes and confrontations and military muscle flexing by both sides in this area over many years. Last year, the South Koreans set a North Korean ship on fire in a clash. The North Koreans sank a South Korean Navy vessel last March, I think largely in retaliation. The South Koreans were staging a military exercise, including artillery fire, when the North opened fire and hit the island. So there's this dynamic here, and I think the South Koreans are trying to send a signal that they're going to be tough, but at the same time, they don't want it to escalate because a new Korean War does nobody any good. But it does create some real policy dilemmas because there are pressures to not look weak in the face of the North Korean assault, and at the same time, the risks if a conflict should spread are horrendous, and the casualties and damage, particularly that South Korea would sustain, would be enormous.
What about the nuclear facility just unveiled by North Korea, so sophisticated, according to the American observer who was shown it? Is there any connection?
I think there is a broader connection. Whether or not this specific incident was part of a wider strategy or not, we simply don't know. It may have just been local circumstances, local North Korean theater commanders reacting to South Korean behavior. But the broader picture is that the North Koreans did show a very respected American nuclear scientist a uranium enrichment facility at their Yongbyon nuclear complex. which they said and he reported at the moment is intended to produce electricity, but which could be turned into something that could produce material for a uranium-based bomb. The context to this is for the last almost 18 months, the North Koreans have been signaling that they want to reengage with the United States, that they'd like direct talks. They sent out signals that they might be willing to return to the six-party talks in Beijing. And ironically, it's been the South Koreans and the U.S. who have balked at getting back into this diplomacy, partly because the South Koreans haven't wanted to in the wake of the sinking of their own naval vessel, and partly because the Obama administration has really let South Korea take the lead in the way in which it deals with North Korea. So there's an element with the North Koreans of saying, if you don't want to talk to us, this is what you get. Think about it.
What about the connection that many people are making between this and Kim Jong-il's son? Supposedly this is a way for him to show that he's strong enough to take over.
There may be some element of that, but by all accounts, the succession, despite many doubts, has gone surprisingly smoothly so far. And also, I think you can fit a lot of what's happening now into patterns of North Korean behavior. This isn't the first time that we've seen the North Koreans mix a sense of provocative actions and steps and muscle flexing with signals that they were willing to negotiate and waiting to see whether or not the U.S. would respond. So there may be an element of it, but the idea that the younger Kim is, you know, making his bones, to borrow the mafia phrase, by being associated with this kind of thing, I tend to be skeptical of that.
Just a couple of seconds left. What about the sanctions against North Korea?
I think this whole episode shows that sanctions don't work. The central tenet of U.S. and South Korean policy towards North Korea for the last year and a half has been pressure, sanctions, and coercion in response to what Washington and Seoul have deemed Pyongyang's bad behavior. It may have inflicted some pain on North Korea, but we can see by the fact that they've erected this new uranium facility and now staged this attack, it isn't changing the way they behave.
Mike Shenoy at USC's U.S.-China Institute, thank you very much, as always, for being on our program. In a moment, does the world face another food crisis? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. In 2008, a combination of natural events and economic conditions drove food prices so high that food riots erupted in many parts of the world. This year, there's concern the same thing may be happening again. But the ravages of 2008 aren't yet over. That's according to Raj Patel, formerly of the World Bank and the WTO, now fellow at Food First, and author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. Raj Patel, thank you very much for being on our program today.
Good to be here, Warren.
What do you mean when you say that the ravages of 2008 aren't over yet?
Well, in 2008, food prices went through the roof, of course, but the recession hit globally. And what that meant was that for the poorest people on Earth, food became even more unaffordable than it was in 2008. So in 2008, there were 850 million people going hungry. And in 2009, the number of malnourished was over a billion. Now, in 2010, the estimates for the number of people who are malnourished has gone down a little, dropped to 925 million people, largely because of improvements in food availability and income in Asia. But in many ways, there's still tens of millions of more people from going hungry now than were in 2008. And for them, the emergency isn't over. It began in 2008, and it has continued to today. And so although prices have gone down for the middle classes around the world, for the very poorest people, things in many ways haven't improved.
Tell us, if you will, what combination of circumstances has come together recently to drive up the price of food?
Well, as I say, I mean, in terms of the international markets, we're seeing a mixture of things. In part, there's speculation in the price of food. In some commodities, there have been strange, or you know, not strange, but just unusual weather events. There have been droughts, for example, and irregular rains in India and in Brazil, which has contributed, for example, to a rise in the price of sugar. There have been failed harvests of tea, for example, in Kenya and again in India and Sri Lanka, and that's led to increases in the price of tea. So it's been a sort of mixture of weather and speculation, and then on top of that, in some commodities, what we've seen is a very sort of firm human hand in the increase in the price of food. So if you look at Russia, for example, Russia is one of the world's largest exporters of wheat, and because Russia had its biggest heat wave in 100 years, there were large fires, and of course those fires spread out of control further because Russia's has cut back spending on its sort of fire control services. But that meant that there were fires in the grain baskets in Russia, and the Russian government announced an embargo on the export of wheat until 2011. And that drove up, that sent to the market a signal that wheat would become more scarce, and that drove up the price of wheat. And so what you have is both a sort of strange climatic event and also a poor policy and the consequence of being integrated so firmly into global markets in food meant that it was a sort of a conspiracy of lots of different circumstances that led to this increase in the price of food. But what happened then was that there were other countries that had to manage that supply shock. And so, for example, in Mozambique, the price of bread went up by 30% because the government subsidizes bread and it couldn't afford to anymore. Now, what that meant was that all of a sudden the price of bread was going up for the poorest Mozambicans. That meant that if you're spending more than 60% of your budget on food, all of a sudden a 30% price increase means that your food budget really doesn't go very far at all. And there were protests on the street of Mozambique, and these so-called food riots happened in Mozambique, as they've been happening throughout the world in 2010. Much less reported have been riots or protests in India and in Serbia and in Egypt. But these protests have been going on, and they're reflective not just of the volatility of prices in the international market, but also of government's failure to be able to deliver food to their citizens. And that's what a number of these food rebellions are about. It's not just about the volatility of prices, but it's also about government's failing to entitle their citizens sufficiently.
You've talked about the entire world, or much of it. Does hunger mean something different in different places, or is there one comprehensive definition of that term?
Malnutrition is the sort of overall definition, and that's about getting a sufficient number of calories per day, and that varies according to age and gender and a small number of other factors. In the United States, for example, the measure of entitlement to food is called food insecurity, and that is a more relaxed criterion insofar as one doesn't need to be eating less than 1,700 or 1,900 calories a day in order to be food insecure. In the United States, food insecurity is captured by the idea that at some point in the last year you were worried about being able to afford the next meal, or you didn't know where the next meal was coming from. So there are a couple of definitions, but these definitions are useful. The idea of food insecurity refers to a very real phenomenon of worrying about where your next meal is coming from. You don't need to have your ribs sort of poking through your skin to be worried about hunger, and for that to matter a great deal in the lives of you and your family. But again, malnourishment and being undernourished is a stricter criterion that does have a more international definition that the Food and Agriculture Organization applies to different countries.
Raj Patel, again, with the Food Institute. His latest book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Nancy Roman is Director of Public Policy and Communications at the United Nations World Food Program. Ms. Roman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
How concerned is the United Nations? What are you watching to see how things are developing?
Yeah. Well, we absolutely are concerned because in many of the countries where we work, and the World Food Program is feeding 100 million hungry people in 74 different countries, food prices remain above long-term averages. So even though we've seen prices come off from 2008, in Bangladesh, for example, the cost of typical food basket is 54% higher than the five-year average. Or in Mozambique, you know, corn costs 96% more than the long-term average. So we are concerned. But, you know, we're trying to be careful not to create a sense of hysteria. You know, the Food and Agricultural Organization put out a report recently that did raise concerns because it said the prices of commodities had risen sharply. And it really warned the international community, look, pay attention to this. And this is after they had played a significant role in calming anxiety after the Russian fires that Raj referenced in August really spiked concerns. So we had 2008 peak concern. Then things began to level in 2009. Then in August with the Russian fires, there was a lot of renewed concern. You know, our sense is we're worried. We're paid to be worried. This is our job. And I agree with everything Raj said about how critical hunger is. I mean, if you don't get the food and the nutrition you need, particularly, you know, from the womb to age two, it has lifelong consequences in mental capacity and health and so forth. So, yes, we care. You know, what are we watching? Well, we're watching a couple of things. There are some differences in 2008. You know, one of the things we watch is supply. So while, you know, food stocks for global commodities like wheat and so forth hit historic lows in 2008, the forecasts for 2010 are predicting it to be a large harvest. So even though wheat prices could be down, it's still predicted to be the third largest harvest in history. So we are watching closely the planting season because it will matter an enormous amount, you know, what is planted and how the next harvest goes. We're also watching oil prices. The high food price crisis in 2008 was driven partly because oil peaked around $150 a barrel. And that's significant because when you get above $90 or $100 a barrel, oil suddenly, biofuel becomes quite lucrative. And so you drive a lot of transferring, you know, food for food to food for fuel. So we're watching that, but current oil prices have been fluctuating between, you know, $70 and $90 a barrel. So that's something that we have our eye on. So we don't want to be too sanguine. Because, you know, look, between now and mid-century, the competition for food and water, I believe, is really going to be one of the driving issue. And it matters. And the world is waking up to it. And so, you know, we're taking some steps to address long-term supply. But, you know, it's critical. And I agree with Raj that part of the reason that people get exercised in these poor countries is not only because food prices spike, but then their governments don't seem to be capable of addressing the problem. And that's something we're really attempting to do at the World Food Program, is to try to help governments establish food security for their people, to position themselves to respond when this happens, so you don't have whole populations, you know, going without food at critical times and then, you know, leaving their children, you know, really damaged for life.
When you talk about planting, for example, is there any effort that's made to coordinate planting worldwide, or is that something that is just left totally to each individual country and the free market?
Yeah, well, the World Food Program, that's not our area of expertise, but yes, the Food and Agricultural Organization, our sister agency at the United Nations, is looking towards, you know, the global crop supply. And, you know, looking not only, you know, I think one of the things there's a lot of discussion about in the international community now is paying close attention to what we plant, you know, which crops do well, maximizing the output not only per hectare or per acre, but also from a nutritional capacity, and really starting to turn more attention to that area. you know, because you've got two issues. You know, you've got one, supply and demand. So I think the international community is rightly paying attention to that issue and others that affect global supply, because we're a population going from 6.8 billion to 9.1 billion mid-century. But another issue that we're paying close attention to is access, because it's not just about enough food. It's not just about planting enough. We could triple the amount of food tomorrow. If I could wave a magic wand and triple the amount of food that we had in the world tomorrow, we would still have hundreds of millions of hungry people, because a huge part of it is about access. And that's our role at the World Food Program, is helping to establish access to food and food security for families and individuals. And that's an issue of infrastructure. Sometimes in urban areas, people have, there's food in the markets, but people have no means to buy it. So we are working on developing cash and voucher programs that can help the poorest of the poor access nutrition. I guess I'd just say, to your question, yes, there are efforts at planting, but our efforts are really in access. And I think it's really critical to pay attention to that piece, because a lot of the world's poor are moving from rural areas to urban areas where there's really plenty of food, but people just, you know, don't have the means to access that food.
Again, Nancy Roman is with the United Nations World Food Program. Arash Patel, back to you. We need to go to a break relatively soon, but let me ask you this question. Is what we're seeing, do you think, becoming a trend? Is this something that's getting worse, that we're failing to get a handle on, or are we doing the best we can?
No, I mean, I think if you look at the ways in which policy has changed since 2008, you'll see that it's changed very little. I mean, what we've managed to do is make some commitments to feeding the hungry, and that's a commitment, sadly, that many governments are reneging on and providing insufficient funds for things like the World Food Program. But in terms of the fundamentals of the causes that led to the crisis in 2008, sadly, the fundamentals are still there. We still have a dependency on oil. We still have ways of growing food that are largely, hostage to markets, more open to speculation than they have been in the past. And governments have responded to the recession by, in many ways, withdrawing, reducing levels of entitlements. And that means that when the recovery gets underway, when the price of oil starts to recover, we will be in a situation where, in fact, we find ourselves facing many of the same policies, but without the basic entitlements. So, if we look to the United States, one of the things that got families through the early years of this, the rise in the price of food, was unemployment benefit. But now what we're seeing is the possibility that after 99 weeks, those who have exhausted their unemployment entitlements in the United States will not have access to that. And in front of the Senate right now is a proposal to cut food stamp aid even further. And that suggests that we're heading down the wrong way to ensure access and entitlement to food.
Raj Patel, again, now with Food First. We'll be back with him, with Nancy Roman and others in just a moment. We're going to take a break first. And on our reporter's notebook a bit later, were U.S. and Afghan leaders tricked into bogus talks about peace with a Taliban imposter? Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're not only back with To the Point, to talking today about the world supply of food, with some food disturbances and riots going on even now. Not quite as bad as 2008, as we've heard so far, but nonetheless, cause of great concern. Let's turn now to the United States. Jonathan Bloom is a freelance journalist. He's a food waste expert. He blogs at Wasted Food, and he's author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Jonathan Bloom, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How do you come up with that figure?
Well, the most recent figure puts waste at about 40% but previous estimates have been higher, approaching 50%. The 40% number comes from an NIH-funded study, so it's fairly solid. And it's just a staggering amount when you think about how much we put into all the food we grow and what goes into growing that food, and then to turn around and not eat almost half of it. I'm still blown away by it.
Talk about the resources we put into it.
Sure. Well, a tremendous amount of fossil fuels through oil go into growing, harvesting, shipping, processing, even cooling our food. And increasingly, a fair amount of water is being used. There was a study that looked at all the water that goes into growing food, and it's almost as much as we put into almost as much oil is used, and increasingly so much more water is used at the same time.
So enormous natural resources, water and fossil fuels, not to mention the land, of course. Is all of the food that is wasted edible?
Well, how I define the term waste, it is only the things that were at one point edible or could be edible. So there's a fair amount of food waste that ends up in the landfill that are things like peels and scraps. But yes, the 40% number are all things that were at one time edible. And the reasons we waste them are many. There's a tremendous amount of food that gets thrown out just based on superficialities, and we've become so specific in terms of what we look for in our food. We not only want it to taste delicious, but we also want it to look perfect. So anything that's the wrong shape, size, or color, or maybe has a little blemish in it, at some point along the food chain, it's cast aside.
Oh, where does that come from? Is that from the grocers? Do they set that standard, or do the consumers do it?
Well, there's a fair amount of blame to go around. I would put it equally in both sides. I think that the grocers think shoppers are fairly picky, and to a certain extent we are. And I understand that if you're faced with the decision of an apple that's perfect and an apple with a slight blemish, you're going to take the one that's perfect. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that something with a little blemish is trash. And so I'd like to see ways to keep it out of the landfill and to actually get it to people who will use it.
What does this all have to do with hunger in the United States or food insecurity?
Well, there's this strange coexistence of so much hunger and so much waste. And at the same time, there's a massive obesity problem. So the only conclusion I can draw from those three factors is that we have a flawed relationship with food, and there's a terrible problem with the distribution of the food that we do grow. We produce about twice the amount of calories that are needed, and then at the same time waste about half of them. So perhaps that's not surprising. What is surprising is the lack of will to get that excess food to people who need it.
Jonathan Bloom, again, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Mark Winnie is author of Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. He was executive director for 25 years of the Hartford Food System. That's a nonprofit in Connecticut that works on hunger issues. Mark Winnie, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You have in mind solutions, it seems to me, at least potential ones, to the kinds of problems Jonathan Bloom just outlined.
Well, I do think that there's a role for all of us. I tend to look at the situation at a more of an individual level or a community level as opposed to sort of the larger institutional levels, in as much as I think that the individual has a major role to play. And in reducing hunger and food insecurity, particularly in the United States, but also in perhaps setting the direction for or changing the direction of the way that our food system operates. Specifically, I think that we all, every single one of us, need to understand more about our food, where it comes from, how it's distributed, why the prices are what they are. In effect, we need to kind of get our heads above the plate. And I recommend three ways of doing this. One is that we actually start to pay more attention to producing food. I mean, this this may sound trivial, but simply gardening is a way for us to really increase our own understanding and appreciation of food, as well as helping us with our own higher food prices, food quality, and so forth. I also recommend that we start to do more about how to cook food, learn more about how to cook food. A lot of our problems in this country around obesity in particular have arisen out of our inability to prepare food that's healthy from unprocessed ingredients, and that we've become more dependent on convenience foods, fast foods, and basically high fat, high salt, etc. And the third way is kind of the big picture, which is participation or democracy. It's not just being a good food consumer, it's being a good food citizen as well. I think that many of the problems alluded to by the previous speakers are ones where we have a lack of or scarcity of citizen participation, of actually becoming more engaged in how decisions get made in our food system. And in fact, we are conceding too many decisions at this point to large corporate food interests, as well as a small number of political leaders.
When you say that gardening is a great way to learn more about food, I understand what you're talking about, but it's not a great way, is it, to learn about industrial agriculture, which is the way so much of our food gets to us? How do you find out about that?
Well, I do think that gardening and cooking, believe it or not, are ways that we can do more to appreciate a certain kind of food that is locally produced, that we have some appreciation for. We can reduce the use of chemicals. We can promote a more sustainable form of food production. When we think about the industrial food system and we think about the kinds of food crisis and spiking food prices that we heard about earlier, I think that part of the solution is for more of us as individuals to participate in producing our own food and to not become dependent on, I'm concerned the most is that we are becoming more dependent on a large-scale agro-industrial system of food production that is relying more and more on biotechnology, factory farming, and the increasing use of agrochemicals. Unless we all begin to understand how we can produce our food differently, we're going to go down a road which may in the long run be the unsustainable approach to feeding those 9 billion people who are showing up for dinner in the year 2050.
Mark Winnie, once again, formerly with the Hartford Food System for 25 years and now author of Food Rebels. And we'll read the whole title again until a bit later on. Raj Patel, let me go back to you, whom we heard from before, now with Food First, formerly with the World Bank and the WTO. It's often said that because of biotech, because of the kinds of industrial strategies that Mark Winnie is deploring, we are able to feed more people around the world. Is there a paradox here?
No, not really. I mean, the story is because of green revolution seeds that were dependent on a great deal of irrigation and a great deal of fertilizer, usually oil, fossil fuel based fertilizer, yields have gone up. There are a couple of problems with equating that with biotechnology. First of all, increasing the numbers of reports are coming in suggesting that, in fact, biotech has the same yield as conventional agriculture. So there's no big improvement despite billions of dollars of investment in biotech in terms of yield. One of the things that biotech does do is allow farmers to spend less time farming so that they can get a second job. But that's hardly, you know, that's an indication of the poor state of the farming economy rather than the benefits to all and sundry that might come from genetically modified crops. But what we're also seeing is, I mean, earlier on this year, there was a report on NPR where one of the chief scientists in Punjab in India, one of the men responsible for promoting the Green Revolution, was suggesting that the majority of Indian farmers needs to go organic because the fossil fuel costs and the cost of inputs are incredibly high. And irrigation has damaged soils in India to the extent that the kinds of farming that appear to have done well in the 20th century are just not suited to the 21st century. And I think Nancy is right from the World Food Program, and she was saying earlier on that the conflicts over resources that allow farming to happen, as well as the conflicts over how it is that we distribute food, are ones that are going to loom large in the 21st century. So I think whatever one's appraisal of the Green Revolution and 20th century agricultural technology, and I think that there's enough evidence to suggest that a very mixed appraisal at best. In the 21st century, we don't have abundant water, we don't have a climate, we don't have mechanisms for distribution that allow a 20th century model to feed the world in the 21st century. And we do need a change. And luckily, there's been a lot of research on sustainable agriculture and on polycultural kinds of farming, kinds of farming that are urban and peri-urban. And it turns out that in fact, there was a report a couple of years back, funded by the World Bank and the U.S. government, a range of other people, suggesting that in 2050, when there are 9 billion people, one of the ways that we'll need to farm around the world are ways that Mark Winney is pioneering, ways of farming that are sustainable, that are polycultural, and that are much lighter in terms of their needs for water and for fossil fuel than the farming system that we grew up with.
Let me go back to Mark Winney. What about, Mark Winney, what Jonathan Bloom had to say about waste, and would we be able to better feed the people here in the United States if we were able to get that under control, or would that just simply be a way of providing food efficiently for those who can afford it?
I think it would be a good idea if we reduced waste. I mean, in every aspect of our lives, I don't think we could argue with that approach at all. I mean, if we were able to reduce the amount of wasted food and the energy that's involved in that. And I mean, I saw one figure that the other day that said if the American obesity rate went down to 3%, which is I think now it's somewhere in the 25 to 30% range, we would be saving 185 million tons of carbon emissions. So there's the impact on the planet, on the environment, would be very positive. However, I'm a little concerned that the argument around waste, and I see this particularly coming from the food bank community in the United States, is that there is somehow a direct link between reducing hunger and eliminating waste. You know, if we are able to get more of the surplus and waste, so-called wasted food, to people who are hungry, we will then eliminate hunger. Well, we will eliminate the immediate need for food on a sort of daily basis, but we will not eliminate hunger, because poverty is the cause of hunger in the United States, not really the lack of food or the lack of food distribution. And I'm concerned that the arguments and the way that this problem gets framed is a little bit too dependent on the connection between waste reduction and hunger reduction. I think the connection is a bit spurious, and it distracts us from the bigger problem, which is poverty.
Jonathan Bloom, back to you, author of America Wasteland. Do you have any objection, argument with that point?
No, I think Mark's right on there. I mean, there isn't a direct relationship between the amount of waste and hunger, but at the same time, it's not to say that we can't do a whole lot better in terms of reducing waste and actually getting some of that food to those who need it. And there are many food recovery operations out there who are doing just that, and not just getting the highly processed foods to those who are hungry, which then lead to health problems further down the line. But they're also going out to farms and reaching out to large farmers who have a tremendous amount of excess of healthy foods. So yeah, I think there's a few things that need to happen. We certainly need to work at the root cause of hunger and that poverty. But I don't think that the two can't coexist.
Nancy Roman, back to you with the United Nations World Food Program. What about this relationship that Americans have to food that's been described by Jonathan Bloom and Mark Winney in particular? And does that have an impact on the way American food affects the way the rest of the world gets fed?
Yeah, well, I think this is actually a critical area of new thinking. You know, I sit on this group that was put together by DFID, the UK's development agency, And they brought together a group of us who meet quarterly. It's called the Foresight Group for 2 years on feeding the planet by 2050. And I was really struck in the early part of that discussion, you know, 2 years ago, about how we were all in our own little cones, you know. So the domestic hunger people U.S. were looking at hunger in the U.S., and the organic people were looking at organic, and the fish farm people were looking at fish farm, and we were looking at access to food for the poorest of the poor in the hardest places. And one of the real benefits of the discussion, I think, was recognizing that to really think about feeding the world in 2050, to understand and acknowledge the nexus. And I very much agree with what Mark said, and I know it can sound simplistic, but I do agree that if people garden and cook and connect a little bit to the food, it becomes easier to recognize the linkages. I know we've, you know, I'm skeptical of suggesting that if people, you know, grew a little more of their own food and ate a little healthier, everything would all work out. The problems of supply and demand and access are enormous. But there is a connectivity. And to be very frank, a lot of, you know, it's going to take the world to solve this problem. So people and policymakers and opinion leaders in developed countries and developing countries coming together to really think through solutions for both supply and access that matter. So, you know, they're big and tough issues, you know, as the global social problems often are. But, yes, I very much, you know, think there is a connection and that more thinking and talking in this space is going to be part of bringing the world to a better place, you know, as we try to feed the hungry worldwide and eat more nutritiously, those of us who have enough to eat.
I almost want to leave the program there because it seems to me it's such a perfect stopping point. But I really would like to go back very quickly once more to Raj Patel and ask, do you foresee that these are problems that are soluble, particularly when it comes to the power of the agribusiness industries in the United States and elsewhere?
Well, I think one needs to be a pessimist of the intellect and an optimist of the will. I mean, if you look at the kind of trajectory we're on at the moment, as we were saying earlier on, there's, you know, particularly if you're a working American right now, things are looking very bleak. You're struggling on less than $150 per person per month for food, and there aren't many places where you can go gardening if you're working, you know, living in the inner cities. On the other hand, there are movements afoot where people are fighting for sustainable change, and the important thing is that it's happening globally. And I think I'm very heartened that, particularly in the U.S. over the past decade, there's been an explosion in the interest in food, not only domestically but internationally. And the U.S. is moving to take a role in transforming the global food system, despite the sort of prevalence of large agribusinesses trying to turn it the other way. So I think what one needs to be clear-sighted about the challenges ahead, but also derive some measure of comfort by the amount of social change and the amount of, you know, the millions of people around the world who are trying to do something about this and who are moving in a very progressive direction.
Raj Patel at Food First, his latest book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Nancy Roman at the United Nations World Food Program. Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Mark Winnie, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Look forward to talking to you all again. A month ago, General David Petraeus said secret talks with a senior Taliban leader showed that the U.S.-led offensive was generating enough pressure that peace might be possible in Afghanistan. There was only one problem. That senior Taliban leader was an imposter. More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. A man who called himself the Taliban's number two leader was flown to Kabul on a NATO plane. He was ushered into Hamid Karzai's presidential palace, paid enough money to show up three times. Now it turns out he was not Mullah Akhtar Mohammed Mansour after all. Carlotta Gall co-wrote the story for the New York Times. It's good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
What happened?
It went on for several months, we know that, and I think the main protagonists, the NATO officials, as far as we understand, and Afghan officials thought they were talking to the top man. And then we have various stories, but one is that an envoy was sent from Karzai, in fact, to one of the meetings, who knew the guy from way back, and he said, this is not Aftar Mansour. It was blown, but the man was still actually allowed to go back. So he wasn't detained. So there's many questions still. Who exactly is he and what were his motives?
So we don't know if, in fact, he did come from the Taliban, that he was some kind of plant or that this was some sort of trick?
He certainly talked the right talk. He convinced them. So he knew all the... I think the positions of the Taliban leadership and so on. My guess is it's something like he was doing it for the money, doing it an opportunist, but probably someone who was linked to the Taliban. But he doesn't seem to have been the right man.
General Petraeus talked this up and said that it appeared that his focus on killing mid-level commanders was forcing the Taliban to the negotiating table. Was he hyping this?
On this one case, he was obviously mistaken, but I think it is happening. I think what this case proves is that the Americans are ready to entertain serious discussions with top leadership of Taliban, which is new, and it's not the only one. There are a lot of talks, and of course, we've been working hard to try and find out who is meeting, what level, what is the discussion, and this is when we came across this case of the man is an imposter, but I think it doesn't mean there's not other things going on and genuine efforts to reach some sort of understanding, to even begin negotiations.
Well, what does it say about the ability of the International Security Assistance Force and General Petraeus to know what they're doing and who they're talking to?
Well, this is a classic. I mean, it's absolutely, as we wrote out of a spy novel, that perhaps they're so keen to listen, to talk to some high-level one, that they don't do the immediate necessary checks. They don't bring in trustworthy people who really do know the Taliban, and there are plenty of those around. So there must be some red faces among the people who are organizing this, because it's a pretty fundamental error. But I think it also shows the tricks that, you know, there's a lot of speculation. Was this a Pakistani, intelligence services plant? Was this a Taliban plant? Was this just a guy out to make money and get some kudos for himself? There's a lot of questions there, and it shows, I think, the real difficulty of trying to go into these negotiations.
If they can't identify somebody who comes into the presidential palace or sits at the table three times, it's reminiscent of the CIA agents that were blown up by a person that they trusted. What does it say about the identification of the people who are being targeted by the drones? Are they really killing the right people?
Well, that's always been a sore point, certainly with the Afghans, because many complain that innocent Afghans are getting killed. I think in some cases the intelligence is thought to be much better these days because there are more people cooperating, or they're listening more to local Afghans in an area to really double-check the identity. But it just does show you how easy it is to make a mistake, or how, in the excitement of a development, people are overlooking the basics.
What would be the motivation for either the Taliban or the Pakistan, for presumably different reasons, to pull off a stunt like this?
I think if you look at the Pakistani attitude of always controlling the Taliban, they were nurturing them from the beginning, they had close relations with them through their time in power, their interest would be possibly to use this as a red herring, waste Americans' time, embarrass them, make them look like fools, but also possibly to actually lead them in a direction, or lead the negotiations in a certain direction that is in the interest of Pakistan. From the Taliban side, I think the hardliners would see it as just a time-wasting exercise, but also to show up America as incapable of conducting good intelligence. And the Afghan intelligence, I think, was also involved, and they've come up off not looking so good.
There was an elaborate story involving this man, and your paper declined to use his name on the ground that it might risk his life to do it. Apparently all that was just fake?
The man himself, you mean? The imposter?
Well, the notion that we better be careful because this guy's real and because he might be taken out if, in fact, his name it gets circulated amongst the Taliban and others that he's dealing with NATO and with the Afghan government.
Yeah, that's the suggestion. Also, just that it could break apart the talks. Because I think when you do have talks, especially with a rebel group, and between a group government and a rebel group or two warring factions, they do often keep the initial contacts very secret because, hardliners on both sides can scupper things, or it makes it very politically difficult for one side to sell the idea to their followers. They have to prepare that politically. So I think there are many feelings of what the sensitivities are. But of course, being journalists, we're also aware that was this just to cover up some embarrassment of a failed operation and a rather ludicrous operation.
Carlotta Gall, Afghanistan correspondent for The New York Times. Very good to have you on our program. Today's program produced by Gary Scott with Katie Cooper and Andrea Brody. Technical director is Phil Richards. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
After North Korea's attack on a South Korean island, tensions are high on one of the world's most dangerous borders. I'm Armin Alney. On To the Point, why so soon after North Korea unveiled a highly sophisticated nuclear plant? What does it have to do with Kim Jong-il's successor and international sanctions? What about South Korea's reaction? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.